Welcome to the Rust Belt Rundown, brought to you by Rust Belt Recruiting. This podcast is designed to shine a light on the meaningful work being done in Northeast Ohio and the surrounding region. We will convene manufacturing executives and Northeast Ohio business leaders for candid discussions about their business, regional happenings, industry trends, entrepreneurship, and more. Now, let's get running on the Rundown.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 59 of the Rust Belt Rundown, a production by Workforce LLC. I'm your host, Paul O'Connor, and on this episode, we are joined by Sandy Doyle Ahern of EMH&T. Sandy, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Happy Friday. I always love recording on Fridays. Everyone's in a good mood. We're headed to the weekend. Unfortunately, Columbus is being dumped on by rain, which maybe we get to later. But let's start off with the fact that it is extremely rare that we have guests on this podcast that have been with their company for more than 10 years. You've been with EMH&T for 26 plus years. What are some of the reasons that I assume there are many that you have been with the same company for that long? It's very rare to see that nowadays.
Yeah. So thanks for the question. I actually think it's sad that it's rare to see that. I think, I know a lot of people have been with their firms a long time, but I think it's also a little bit generational possibly. Mm-hmm. For me personally, I came to EMH&T after a few years of working on my own, and they've been a client of mine. So when I came and joined the company, it was just a great place to be in terms of culture, in terms of the way that people function together, heads down, get the work done, strong work ethic. And so for me, it just really aligned in how I like to function. But for me, over time, what happened was getting to be part of an organization that I got to start a whole new group of the company. I was given a lot of autonomy to do that. And so, everybody sort of stayed out of my way, let me run this group. It became pretty integrated into the way that we're functioning today. And so that kind of opened doors for me to do other things in the company, run other divisions of the company. And then eventually I became a shareholder of the company in 2006. And so if you had told me, 26 years ago when I walked in here, that I would be running the company someday, I would have said, no way, and laughed, and that would have been the end of it. But it's just been a great place to be, and I just couldn't imagine actually being anywhere else.
So it sounds like, obviously the culture, that's the easy part, right? I mean, you got to enjoy what you're doing and who you're doing it with. But then it sounds like there was some, strategy and intentional thought process around where people can go within the company. And you've had, four, five, six different roles. I think that plays a large part too, because I think sometimes people get to a spot and they think there's going to be, some growth trajectory, and then they find out there isn't, and then they hop. Mm-hmm. So how important is that for companies to lay that out? Even if it's a junior level employee, like, here is where you can go within the company if you stay for 26 years.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think every organization struggles with that a little bit. And depending on the kind of organization you are, that pathway being laid out might actually be easy for someone to describe. Hmm. In our particular case, I would tell you it isn't. It's because we're in consulting engineering, what we're doing every day is problem solving every single day. And so the way that those pathways evolve actually isn't by some prescribed ladder that you do this and then you do this, then you do this. What it's really about is best fit for people. And so we're in a bit of luxurious position as a company to be able to say that. What I mean by that is if you've got somebody who really enjoys the work, but maybe doesn't want to be in front of clients, they're more technical, they like doing design work, they would rather focus their day on doing that and not have to, really be in front of people and speaking and all that kind of thing, then that pathway exists for them. For somebody else, that pathway may be completely different. And they may say, I love being in front of clients. I want to do the daily problem solving. I want to be challenged by that. And that's the pathway I take. They could actually enter the company with exactly the same credentials. Ultimately, they're going to take a different path because they're different people. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually really careful to not lay out, here's exactly what it should be. We're way more interested in who the person is. And then depending on who they are and how they are, there's going to be a pathway for them. There's no question. And ultimately for us, what happens is somebody that might want to take maybe a more technical pathway, they might get to the point where the what their daily job looks like is in the weeds. They're in the details. They're doing the detailed design and they love it. And if they love it, that is the perfect fit for them. Mm-hmm. What we don't want to do is put that person in a sort of square peg round hole situation where they're forced to do something that they're not really comfortable doing. Because the truth is people gravitate to what they like. It's just mm-hmm. how life is. So, we try to work pretty closely with individual people to help them figure out what that looks like and then pivot. You know, if it turns out that it's not the right choice or a different door opens for them, you have to let them go through it. So that's a lot of how the company is structured. And actually, to your point a second ago, it does feed into culture. Yeah. It really, it's almost one and the same, because if you have people who feel like they can take their career in whatever direction they want it to be, then culturally, what you're doing is creating an environment where people like to work together and you build trust with teams. And that matters an awful lot. Yeah. So that's kind of how it works for us. And my pathway is pretty similar.
Yeah, I love it. For our listeners who may not be aware, can you tell our audience more about EMH&T and the vast solutions that you offer? Because it's a lot.
Yeah. So the company is, we're just shy of 100 years old. We're coming up on that here in the next couple of years. And what we do is design, engineering, surveying. We do environmental consulting, land planning, things like that. And so in the world we work in, we're essentially what you would refer to as consulting engineers. So somebody might come to us from a municipality. Could be the city of Columbus. It could be anybody else in the municipal world that has a particular infrastructure project that needs to get done in their community. So we will do the design for it. We'll help them with public interface. Sometimes we might help them find funding for the project. There's a whole host of things that come with designing infrastructure. But in the public world, what we're essentially doing is stewarding tax dollars for infrastructure. Then there's what I would call the private side of the business, which is going to be organizations that are private companies or quasi-private companies that have either development in their genre, or it could be a healthcare institution that's building a new hospital. It could be a shopping center that's adding capacity to their mall, whatever. That's kind of what we would refer to as private work. Mm-hmm. So in that particular case, what we're doing is preparing their site for that building. So we're going to do everything ground level and below. We're not architects. We're looking at roadway design. We're looking at utility design. We might be looking at park improvements, things like that, that are literally, I would say, horizontal work across the landscape. And that's in the world of civil engineering.
Love it. Yeah. And just incredibly, like, not only like detailed and niche and focus, like how does someone get involved in that work? Like what would they have to major in college or be interested in to work for you guys? Like what is the path to get there?
Yeah. So actually there's quite a few. So we have in the world of true engineering design, which would be truly a civil engineer. So that's a licensed profession. You're going to get a degree in civil engineering. You're going to work for a few years to gain the experience to actually be qualified to get your license. Just like a doctor or lawyer, it's a licensed profession. And so there's a specific pathway laid out by state law where you might graduate from college with a civil engineering bachelor's degree, but then you're going to come and work for us. We're going to teach you all the things you need to know to actually take the exam and you get your license. Survey is similar. So we also run a lot of survey crews. It's also a licensed profession. So you're going to graduate in survey and then have to gain the experience to get the license. Beyond that, though, there's a lot of variety. So, for example, we have a number of environmental scientists here. We have archaeologists here. They're going to have degrees in environmental work or anthropology. We have a number of people that are in the field who might have a high school degree, who haven't gone to college, and we absolutely love having people come in who just want to be in the field. So we will train them how to use the survey equipment, how to be on the land, so to speak, either in construction, survey, or even in a whole other division of the company we have that does sewer televising. So there is a wide variety, but from a professional licensing standpoint, to your question, it's civil engineering or survey.
Got it. So you got your start in 1997. you were leading EMH&T's first environmental department. I have to imagine in 1997, environmental department looked a little bit different than it would today. Can you tell us what that consisted of when you started versus where it's at today?
Yeah, I mean, so essentially what had happened up until that point is that we had some common clients a partner of mine and EMH&T had some common clients. So we were already doing environmental work for some of those clients. So she and I actually came over to EMH&T and opened up this division. And now we're sort of in-house doing the same kind of work. But what basically happened was we needed to start hiring people pretty quickly. And those are people who have environmental science backgrounds, who helped in the field, who helped with regulatory compliance work, things like that. And, it actually grew pretty quickly over the first few years, just because the amount of work that EMH&T was producing that needed those types of support services was actually pretty extensive. They just hadn't been doing it prior to me coming over here. So, I think by the time trying to remember when I left that department, there were probably about maybe 15 people in the department. Today, it's a little bit bigger, but really what's more important is the diversity of the work that the group mm-hmm. does. And it's pretty extensive. So it's going to be similar to what I said, lots of public work, lots of private work, and pretty important to almost every project that we touch, actually.
Love it. Okay, so let's jump into Central Ohio. You would have to be living under a pretty big rock to not hear the word Intel here in Columbus over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. But besides Intel, from my vantage point and my point of view, I think the second most talked about issue for Central Ohioans is housing. And you have a very unique vantage point. You've been focused on this and working on affordable housing for a very long time, the vast majority of your career. Can you talk about not only your work in this space, but then also like where we are, where Central Ohio is in terms of, if 100% is capacity and we're the perfect city in the entire world and everyone has a house, where are we on that scale? But first, just talk about your involvement, your work in the space, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. Yeah, I appreciate the question because actually I'm glad people are talking about it more. We should have been talking about it at the level we're doing it today, 10 years ago, maybe even 15 years ago. So I'm grateful that it has become a mainstream topic because it is something we really need to address. The truth of the matter, though, is that the problem that we're finding ourselves in today, we've had it for a long time. People just didn't really totally understand how it worked or how it might affect them. So Intel has raised an interesting point for us because the reality is nothing about Intel has caused us to be in the situation we are today with housing. What it's done is put it on people's radars in a different way. And that's a really important thing to understand because we sit here today with rent rates rising, a lack of supply, single family home prices going up, et cetera, et cetera. Intel doesn't even have their people here yet. So, it's a catalyst for a conversation is how I try to think about it. So what I would tell you is you have to kind of look at the demographics of the region and you have to look a little bit at where we were in terms of housing supply, call it 10, 12, 15 years ago to really understand what's happening today. The reality is this, if you look at the situation in the 1990s and early 2000s with housing, we were building units at a pretty good pace, keeping up with population, keeping up with growth, et cetera. But what happened is you have to overlay three things. In 2008, when the housing crisis happens and the banking crisis and everything that came with that, obviously housing stopped and it just fell off of a cliff. That's true across the United States. There's nothing unique about Columbus when you think about it that way. But here's the layering of the other two things that begin to make our situation today even more acute. The first is that we are building more housing today than we were in 2008, but we have yet to reach the levels we were prior to 2008. Okay, so in terms of units, which you can track by building permits, the number of thousands of units we're building every year is still not where it was prior to the recession. So that's the first piece. The second piece is that the region is growing in population much more rapidly than it was. And so all of our census data will show us that. You can see that across Ohio. We see Ohio shrinking in general, but Columbus region growing. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a net gain in Ohio, it's a lot because of what's happening in Columbus. And that's not a necessarily a good thing, bad thing. It's just the facts. Yeah. So you layer that population growth on top of a supply that's still not where it was before. And then there's a third piece. The third piece is what I would call our economic development success. So what I mean by that is if you look back 10, 15, 20 years ago, Columbus had a lot going on. It was growing, but it has become a city that is on the radar nationally and even internationally in a way that it never was a decade ago. Yep. And that is very deliberate. That is not by accident. It is not without a tremendous amount of work by, frankly, what used to be Columbus 2020, which is now One Columbus, mm-hmm. not without a lot of work from the state of Ohio. There were a lot of people engaged in economic development activity that has brought a lot of companies to come to the region who see Central Ohio as a good place for them to locate. So it's beginning to change the landscape, not only of the population, but of who is coming to Central Ohio and locating their companies and therefore bringing in hiring more people. So when you layer all of those things together, what you see happening then is we're not only behind in housing supply, but we're not able to keep pace with the projected future at all. We're not even close. And so the result we're seeing is two really distinct things. The first is price pressure. Okay. It's causing, you know, this is simple demand, supply and demand economics, right? Yep. There's not enough supply. There's tons of demand. And so you see rents rising basically because the number of units that are available is not as big as it needs to be. And then the second thing is on the kind of single family new builds, the price points for a lot of those homes are higher than some people can afford, frankly, when you're entry level or starting a new job or whatever, because the market is there for it.
Yeah.
And so what is happening is we're seeing not only market pressure, but we're seeing an increased disparity happening. And that's the part that is deeply concerning because we have a population of people here who get left behind. And it is very acute. And it's very concerning, and it's something we all should be cognitive of. And to add one more point, I know I'm kind of giving you a lot here, but to add one more point that's really important for people to understand about housing is that in leaving people behind, what we're actually doing, in my opinion, is impacting all of that achievement in the economic development space, because we're isolating people. It absolutely follows along racial segregation lines. You just can't ignore it. And it gets us into a whole host of other conversations about workforce opportunity, education opportunity, healthcare outcomes, how you help people get access to jobs.
Yep.
And so anyway, without going too far into that, it is a complicated problem. And on one hand, I would tell you we're fortunate because there are lots of cities around the country that don't have this problem.
Yeah.
Meaning we have a moment where we could get it right. If we're careful, if we're thoughtful, if we try to take care of everybody and not certain people only, we could do this really, really well. There are lots of cities across the U.S. that have struggled with this problem before Columbus ever has. And so we've got lots of examples of what not to do. But I also see it as a window where if we don't get it right, we could follow the pathway of other cities who struggle with this. So we have a very real problem on our hands that is not just a social services issue. It's an economic development issue. And I'll stop there because I could kind of talk about this forever. There are a lot of good people trying to do a lot of good things, but we have to all be very aware of the situation that we're in today.
So I want to come back to a couple of things. One, a lot of good people that are focused. That's the second question. But I do think, you know, one of Columbus's, right? Like my family, my wife and I moved from New York, right? One of the main reasons was affordability, right? You're moving to Columbus right. because there's good job opportunities, economic development, great place to raise a family. There's a lot of good, but one of the main, got to be top three, affordability. And then, you know, forget about it, right? Like there's no traffic. I can park wherever I want, right? Like I have a very different vantage point than someone born and raised in Columbus. I think I can drive and park anywhere. Someone from Columbus may not think that. Anyway, Columbus, to your point, is on a teetering point of like becoming a Denver or an Austin, where all of a sudden they didn't keep up. Too many people moved in. And now you can't. If you're trying to move to Austin, you better be making $180,000 a year. I mean, it's a joke to try and move there. Denver, same thing, super expensive now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Columbus, we're not there yet, but mm-hmm. we're approaching it, right? And so I want to get your thoughts there. But then two, I'll ask it this way because I think it'll invoke a response. Like, who's responsible ultimately to ensure mm-hmm. that we solve this problem? And it's probably 10 different organizations and part government, part private, part home builders. But ultimately, who does this land on if in 2030, Columbus is in the city of like, well, it's the fourth most expensive Midwest city and we become Chicago, you know, whatever it is. Like, whose job is this?
Yep. Okay, so I grew up outside Philadelphia, so I know exactly what you mean. When you come to Columbus, it feels lovely. It's very affordable. Yes. It's easy to get around. People think that a 20-minute drive to downtown that might get clogged up a little bit is a big deal, and it's just not.
It's not.
Perspective really matters because it is in a good place that way, even mm-hmm. though we're talking about it as though we're in a desperate situation. So why I think we have to talk about it like a desperate situation is because infrastructure takes so long and is so expensive to take care of. And when I say infrastructure, I'm talking about everything. Educational infrastructure, healthcare infrastructure, roadways, all the typical things you might think of. There's no point in bringing lots of jobs to the region if people can't get to them, right? So we've got to think ahead. And that's why I try to be optimistic about the fact that we can do this. We're not in a dire situation yet, but we've got to get to the responsibility question, which I'll answer in a second, about how we do it. However, I'm going to say there's one caveat to what I'm saying. We also have a history of really significant racial segregation in this community. Mm-hmm. You cannot overlook it. We have a history of redlining that is very clearly data-driven, tied to outcomes that we know today have affected people. And so while it's easy to move here and say it's wonderful because it is, I wouldn't want to live anywhere else, to be honest. It's a great city. It's offering more and more than it ever has. It's attractive for young people now to stay here and want to have their own families here. So there's all kinds of amazing things going for it. But you have to be willing to look past that to say, if it's good for me, how do I make it good for somebody else? And so it's important to make sure that we're recognizing when we try to address some of the obvious surface problems like traffic and so forth, that we're also thinking about how to build housing and education opportunities and workforce development and healthcare, so forth for everybody. It's a tall order. I mean, look, you know, the Columbus Partnership and others have embraced the goal of wanting to be the most prosperous region in America. That's a heck of a goal. And so what does that mean? And how do you really make that phrase work for everybody? That's our challenge. So to your question about, you know, who's responsible, I will tell you everybody. And here's why I say that. There's policy, which is handled often by government, right? There's job growth and job opportunity that's handled often by private businesses, sometimes by government. They work together. But every single one of us who has a place to live is a neighbor to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so while we can write lots of policy and we can do lots of development and bring jobs and bring education to the community, as neighbors, we have to be willing to have new neighbors.
Yes.
And fundamentally, the way things work in the development world is you start with planning and zoning. And when you are looking to do a new apartment building, a new single family residence, a senior housing, it doesn't really matter what it is. For the most part, you're going to go through a planning and zoning process. And Ohio is a home rule state that allows every community to have its own way of being, which, by the way, for a lot of reasons can be very positive. So mm-hmm. It's not just a bad thing. But what it means is every single community is going to have its own standards, its own way of wanting to think about how their community develops. And so when you get people wanting to come into communities to try to add capacity, add housing, provide opportunities for other people to live there, often what happens is the neighbors are the first ones to say, we don't want this. And I'm not saying that they're right or wrong. You know, everybody has their way of thinking about it. Lots of people want to preserve their particular lifestyle. That all makes sense and it's understandable. The reality is, though, the effect is that if we don't overcome some of these things and provide the housing for people on this population trajectory, we will find ourselves in trouble. And so what we're seeing on the opposite side of the spectrum is that because people can't find a place to live, they're moving further and further and further and further out. And so what I find interesting about Central Ohio is there's really nothing stopping urban development, urban growth, urban sprawl, call it whatever you want, from a landscape perspective. There's no mountains, there's no oceans, there's nothing physically stopping it. The one thing that does control it, and it's a whole conversation you probably don't want to get into, but it's is essentially water and sewer.
Yeah.
So providing utilities is the thing that actually is the controlling point.
Yep.
But putting that aside for a second, we talk about traffic. And if you're a young person who's moved here, who, you know, makes a reasonable entry-level salary, and you're trying to find a place to live, and you can't because the price point's too high, what are you going to do? You're going to either try to find an apartment to live in, or you're going to go further and further out to build that house. So we're already beginning to see the effect of sprawl. This is an example of something that has been done in many places across the country. When I say we don't, you know, have to repeat the mistakes that have been made, there's lots of examples. This isn't rocket science.
Yep.
But here's the other issue. And that is the, what we're seeing from a homelessness standpoint right now is we exceeded our capacity in 2009 with housing for homeless families and even in the single family or single individual population because of the recession and all the things that happened. Well, we've never really recovered from that. Mm. And so you see people who simply cannot afford to find anywhere to live. And it is increasing our homeless situation. And to be really clear about homelessness, it's so important for people to understand that being homeless is not translating to somebody standing on a street corner with yep. a cup asking for coins. These are families. These are people who have jobs. These are companies that we all would recognize who are trying to make ends meet. And so, yes, you have people who are in the situation where they're standing on the street corner. There are, and I'm not going to pretend there isn't, but so much homelessness is actually not visible. And so we are going to see it in this region become more and more visible to the neighbors, and it's coming. So that's why I would tell you everybody. And so we can talk about a little bit more if you want to get into it, as far as what, you know, what can government do? What can private business do? But neighbors have to be willing to have new neighbors.
Yep.
And it's a hard thing. I get it. And I understand people have their emotions and opinions about it. Not every development is suited for every location. So it's not a blanket thing to say everybody just has to put up with whatever. That's not what I'm saying. But we do have to be more willing to recognize change in our community.
Mm-hmm.
The last point I would make on what's happening in the region is we have a lot of new Americans who have come to the region. And interestingly enough, a large percentage of Columbus's population growth is the result of new Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fascinating to look at the demographics, because while we're attracting people to come for jobs or college students at Ohio State or whatever to stay, We also have a lot of new Americans, and that's going to continue to change the landscape of what the needs in the community are as well.
Yep.
Long answer to your question.
No, that was great. Yeah, there's definitely a little bit too much of that NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard mentality, which is, you know, people need to get over. And then to your point, Columbus has grown out, not up. It's, you know, it's time to now grow up, right? Like, we need to get a little bit more dense before we keep going out. And so that's a good transition. Let's talk about infrastructure, right? Columbus is a city that is designed for cars and driving, for better or for worse, right? And we're finally starting to pick up some momentum for some rail service, the Amtrak and the 3Cs and D with Dayton. What are your thoughts on the project? I think from my, you know, I'm still new to Columbus. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this came up maybe 10 to 15 years ago and got voted down relatively quickly or easily, I'll say. And that's the opposite now, obviously, with the federal funding, with the Infrastructure Act, like, there's more money. What are your thoughts on the project? Should it happen? Will it happen? What do you think?
Well, as someone who grew up outside Philadelphia and would often get on the train to go to New York or down to DC or whatever, I grew up in a place where you didn't think twice about it. I never thought to be grateful for it because it was just there all the time until I moved here. And it was like, wow, okay, we have only one way to get around. I think it's fantastic. I hope it happens. I think the opportunity to get on the train and be in Chicago or whatever is going to be really exciting.
Yep.
So I'm hopeful for it. I think what it will do, though, in all reality, it's not going to affect our regional movement. It affects our ability to go to another city.
Mm-hmm.
And so we still have to address what's happening in our region. So in other words, if Amtrak is here and it happens, fantastic, but it doesn't help me get from here to, say, downtown or over to Dublin or whatever. And so I would say I'm optimistic about the rail. I hope it happens. We also have to really, really think about the regional transportation opportunities.
Yeah.
And there will be a lot of conversation continuing to come around the Linkus initiative, which is out there still. It's something that's going to help us think about redevelopment along corridors that allow people to work, live, play in the same location. So you're not going to see rail solve that problem. You're going to see more of a bus rapid transit model potentially solve that problem, things like that. I do think regionally we are much more open to thinking about different modes than we used to be. So I think there's a lot of positive momentum. The reality is, you sort of started off saying it in the very beginning, the challenge is you got to make those decisions today because it takes decades to fix it. And the longer you wait to try to put these other mobility options in place, the more infrastructure you either have to undo and redo or lock down. And so the other, you know, the piece that becomes important to this is other mobility options. I think Columbus as a city is becoming much more interested in combining biking opportunities and walkability and so forth on other modes of transportation besides bus rapid transit or rail. I think a lot of suburban communities are trying to do the same thing. They're doing some really cool work around trying to create those livable, walkable communities.
Yep.
So again, I'm going to be optimistic and say we can do this.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to make some bold, big regional decisions. This is not Columbus's problem to solve. This is Central Ohio's problem to solve. And so the suburban communities and the city of Columbus have to work hand in hand along with the counties to try to solve all these problems. And I do think, interestingly, again, these are problems we've had for ages. They're not new. But Intel being in the conversation, right, wrong, or indifferent, has also sparked continued conversation about we really need to make things happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah, 100%. All right, let's shift gears a little bit. You currently serve on multiple boards across the community that serve a variety of purposes and different people. My question to you is, what advice would you give to young people that are looking to get involved in their community, either serving on a board or volunteering, or, you know, CYP, Columbus Young Professionals does a really good job. Like, what would your advice, you know, maybe for a 25-year-old, they're on their first or second job and they want to get more involved. What's your advice to them on how they can do that?
I really appreciate that question, because I just tell you, doing a lot of work in the community, there's so much need. And so I love even talking about this. So let me go back to my own story, because it's kind of how I got involved. For me, it was probably, gosh, I don't know, 16 years ago, maybe. Love my job, love what I was doing every day, raising my family, you know, things were great. But I just felt like something was missing for me personally, as much as I loved everything I was doing. And a little bit of it is just how I'm wired. I like community service. I think I'm in a fortunate place. And I think giving back to me is really, really critical to a good life. And so anyhow, a few years ago, I had that missing feeling, and I'd never been on a board. I really wasn't sure even what that meant, but I started looking around a little bit and got really interested in the work of the YWCA, because they were doing work around homelessness. They were doing work around kind of women's empowerment, things like that. And so I just ended up doing a little bit of research on them, ended up finding out who the board chair was and approaching them and saying, look, I don't even know what it takes to get on this board, but I'm interested. If anyone ever wants to talk to me about it, I'd love to do that. Is there any committee work I could do, any volunteer work I could do? And so ultimately what ended up happening then was an opportunity to have a conversation about being on the board. And then I ended up on that board, and I was on that board for, a little over 14 years. So that ultimately led to some other opportunities. And now I'm at the point where I really only do the boards that I'm passionate about. So to answer your question, you have to have an interest in the work. The worst thing you could do is join the board of an organization you don't actually have the passion for. And the reason is because when you're on a board, you have a fiduciary responsibility to that organization. Your job isn't to run the organization. Your job isn't to get in the weeds on it. Your job is to support the mission, support the leader of the organization, support the staff in whatever work they're doing. And so you have to care about it. Mm-hmm. So the best advice for anybody who's interested in it is find what you care about first. If what you care about is issues related to cancer, go find a place to take that energy. If you care about issues related to childcare or education or whatever it may be for you, there are so many nonprofits in Columbus. I think we're around 12,000 right now. And you know this well. I mean, the work you do, you guys connect those people. So thank God for what you guys do. But what I would say is, if you combine the number of organizations that are out there with the need, there's a lot of room for people who are young and interested in this to get involved. And they may not get a board seat right away. It may be doing some volunteer work, going in, asking to be on a committee, learn what they're doing, and then demonstrate your interest. And lots of people are looking for young board members right now, because those of us who've been doing this for a long time and are sort of in a really strong network of people in the region who care about the community, and there are a lot of people, we all are kind of looking back ourselves and saying, you know, who can we help bring along to take the work forward? Because at the end of the day, if we don't do that, then we're actually not servicing these organizations the way that we need to. So I don't think it's as hard as what people might think. Reach out. I mean, gosh, we all have access to things like LinkedIn, doing work through your organization and being a volunteer at an organization elsewhere. Those are foot in the door opportunities for really anybody. So you just got to show the interest and kind of go after it. And it likely can happen.
Yep. Yeah. That's a good, it sounds simple, right? To your point, like you just have to reach out. I think people get maybe a little nervous, or they're anxious, or, you know, they're afraid they're going to say, no one's going to say no if you're trying to help, right? No one's going to. Now, to your point, you may not get a board seat right away, whatever it is, But if you ask someone, how can I help? The answer, there's going to be something, right? And so I think people just have to have that approach where, yeah, it may not be exactly what you're looking for right now, but as long as, I think that's a really good point you said, as long as you care about it, it can't be surface level, right? It can't be, oh, I think I should join this board because it's good for my career. No, no. Join something that, you know, you care about, like in your off time, right?
Yeah. And I'm glad you just said that, because the worst thing you can do is join a board because you think it's good for your career. Mm-hmm. Because what happens in that situation is it's a bit disingenuous. And the truth of the matter is, when you serve on a board of any organization, you find out the good, the bad, and the ugly. That is how it works. So the shininess of an organization that you might say, gosh, I would love to be part of that. When you sit from the outside, they're doing amazing work. They're this, they're that. Yes, they're doing all those things. Mm-hmm. But sitting on a board, as I said, you have a fiduciary responsibility. It is not a resume builder. You have to be in it. You have to be sometimes willing to make hard decisions, have difficult conversations. It's not all shiny feel good all the time. That can happen, but you have to realize you're providing service. And so, and you know, you're a volunteer. Every board I sit on, I'm a volunteer. And so you got to be willing to put the time in, but the reward is huge because you get to interact and learn about and know people you would never know in your normal day-to-day job or with your friends or whatever. And for me, back to my original point, that was the gap filler for me. Once I started doing that, you know, I really realized that that for me personally was the thing I needed that I didn't have from my job or from raising my family, which I love doing. I mean, those are all great things. But personally, I was looking for something more, and it absolutely filled that hole for me, and I've never looked back since.
Okay, so let's talk about the Edge Sisters. Talk to us about how this group formed, the work that you guys were correct me if I'm wrong, it was 2020 it was formed? Is that right?
Yeah, it's like such a blur now because of COVID. Yeah, I think it was 2020. It was end of 19 into 20, yeah.
So tell us about that. Like what you guys, the work you're focused on, what you're now focused on now in 2023 and who's in it, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, sure. So the funny thing is it's not an organization. It's not a club. It's not a thing you can join. What happened was, I mentioned a moment ago that there's a number of us in the community that are in business or nonprofit roles for our day jobs, but who also have a real passion for community work. And so we would see each other out all the time at events, at philanthropic events, just in the community, whatever. And every single time that I would see one of, it's all women, see these women, individually, we would always get into the same conversation. What do you think is happening in the community? Is it moving fast enough? What can we do better? How do we help? How do we, you know? And so, as I'm interacting with all these different women, it was like, man, we need to get together and talk about this because there is such a passion and energy for using the opportunity we have in the positions we have to try to do something more. And so, it was at the end of 19 or very beginning of 20. I can't remember now. I just invited everybody to dinner. It was literally like, let's just go have dinner and let's see if there's any synergy around us trying to get together and work on some of these problems. Understanding fully, every single woman at that table has a really busy job, a big job, a high profile job. And we're already all on lots of boards. But when you have a common passion with people, it sort of transcends all that. So we sat down and had dinner, and what you could probably expect from a bunch of type A women is, you know, we're going to come out and be like, yep, let's go. Yep. And so we then kind of said, what is it we want to do? What we know you can't burn the world. It's just not going to happen. And there's already lots of good people doing lots of good work, but what can we do with our voices to try to make a difference? And so we planned on dinners, monthly dinners, to try to kind of really sketch that out. We get to 2020, everything shuts down. You know, we had no idea this was coming at the time we started to get together and talk about this. And so here's the really fascinating sidebar that happened. All of the sudden, we had to switch how we were getting together. We get onto these Zoom calls. We started meeting weekly. And the sidebar thing that happened was we all run organizations. And so all of us all of a sudden were faced with massive decision making about what to do. You know, there's no playbook. There's nobody to talk to. Nobody can tell you what to do, not to do. All you could do is listen to the healthcare data, you know, listen to the guidance that was coming out and make decisions. And so we got thrust into a situation where we literally would use these calls to say, oh my God, you know, either you need a brief moment of levity to find something to laugh about.
Yeah.
Or somebody would be in tears going, oh my God, like this is a thing that happened. And what do you guys think? And so it became like this sort of support network.
Yeah.
So fast forward, where we really landed was wanting to try to push for education around issues of racism. I mean, it's that simple. We are a mixed group of women who have had very different experiences in our lives. We have different jobs today, but even amongst ourselves, we began to have some really robust conversation about race. And so we ended up doing something we knew was going to be a little controversial, and we were okay with that, which was to bring Robin DiAngelo to Columbus and have her talk to the community about issues around race. And so it was supposed to be an in-person event initially. Yeah. You know, we were going to get a theater, have her come speak. COVID happens. We have to change this whole thing. We ended up being able to partner with the Columbus Library, which was fantastic.
Nice.
Because they actually let us use their platform for doing kind of video calls. And it was free. So we covered the cost of her coming. And what happened, because we were able to use that platform, we had about 2,500 people in Columbus get on and listen to her. And it was incredible. So, yeah. So, I mean, here's the bottom line. You know, we have done some race work together, just the small group of us, and been honest and bare bones about it. And it's been really, I think, great for all of us. We have brought people to the community to try and kind of introduce different topics. And it's not a fundraiser. It's not associated with a nonprofit. It's just community conversation. We've also done a couple of other small events. So what we sort of pivoted to in the last year or so is we realized that there were a number of women who had come into the community into brand new roles outside of our group that didn't know anybody. They either moved from another city or they got promoted into a role in the region that is an important job, and they're isolated. So especially someone that moved here, they didn't know anybody. They're operating in COVID conditions. And so we've done a couple of gatherings for that group of women to just come and get to meet each other, get to meet us, just know that there's a network of people out there who can help and support. And, you know, you just got to have each other's back sometimes.
Yep.
So that's essentially what it is. And we're just a group of people that care about the community. We're all still really engaged in our own way in how we interact with the community. And it's something I think we at heart all really care about. So it's that simple. It's just a group of people that care.
Awesome.
That's all it is.
Awesome. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, Sandy, we're going to get you out of here on this. Rapid fire questions to end the episode. This has been fantastic. So we have four rapid fire, and then we're going to give some free publicity to your favorite restaurants in Columbus. But first rapid fire question. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
You know, I would say the best phrase I've ever seen. It wasn't told to me, but it's something that I still believe in. And it's this, the phrase is, in order to become a leader, you must first become who you are. And I heard that piece of advice years ago. And for me, that's always been really impactful because, yeah, you can't lead other people if you haven't figured out who you are. Mm-hmm. So I think it's still the best piece of advice I've probably ever seen.
What is the worst piece of advice you've ever heard or been given?
That you can't balance everything. It's just not true. I actually hate the word balance because I actually get this question a lot. You know, how do you find work-life balance? And the answer is That's just a question no one should ask, because what it looks like for me is entirely different than what it might look like for you or anybody else. And so I never think it's good advice, because you have to decide for yourself what that looks like. And I also would say it's bad advice, because you change. You know, what looked for me like good work-life balance when I was 30 and had two little kids looks completely different with my kids in college and gone. And so people have to not ask that question, because it actually does you a total disservice, because you're never going to find it unless you figure out for yourself what it is.
Yeah, there's not an answer, right? It's different for everybody. So people search for it's 9 to 6 and then I go home. It's going to change, and it's what works for you. What's your favorite book you've ever read?
Oh man, I love to read. So that's a hard question.
You could do the most recent book if that's too hard.
Well, what I would tell you is I think one of the most interesting books I ever read was a book called Serum. Mm. It's been out there for a really long time. And the reason it's really interesting is because it is a history of family lineage from 10,000 years ago to, I think it ends in the late 1980s. And it's just an incredible read. It takes place in England, and it takes you all the way from this family who partly was responsible for building Stonehenge all the way up to, you know, present day. And so it's an excellent book. I loved reading it, but I love to read. So I've loved lots of good books. Big fan of Jodi Picoult. Love to read anything that's been banned.
Yes. Agreed.
Why are we reading books?
that's a whole other podcast, and also just a terrifying reality that we're seeing in our country right now. Last rapid fire question, who inspires you?
You know, my dad passed away a couple years ago, and I think the reason I'd tell you, he grew up in poverty in England. It's a whole long story. Had a tough way of growing up at the end of World War II, and worked really, really hard. And my father followed the decline of the textile industry from England to Canada to the US. And, you know, I remember when I was probably a sophomore in college that the plant he was running closed and he lost his job. And the next day that man was out driving for Domino's Pizza. Wow. And I just, you know, that to me, that work ethic, that I'm not going to give up kind of attitude was always really inspirational to me. And like I said, he passed away 2 years ago, and I miss him every day, because he was just a fascinating person to me. So it was my dad.
I love it. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Last question, free publicity, favorite restaurant, or two or three, whatever you want to give in Columbus.
Oh, that's so hard. You're going to get me in trouble.
I know. Usually the hardest question.
You know, one of my favorite places to go actually is True Food. The reason is because, and I'll plug it, because we all know the great restaurants in town. There are amazing restaurants, and I'd have to name every one to not get in trouble. So, but the reason I like going there is because we used to ride horses out in Arizona a lot at Christmas time, and they had one out there. And so we'd go all the time, and it finally came to Columbus a few years ago, and it's different. It's got great foods. There's organic options. It's just really great. So I'll plug True Food.
and what I love about that is every time you leave there, you feel great. You don't feel
absolutely full.
You don't feel bloated, right? You feel great. You feel because you just ate something really good, whatever it is. Everything on the menu is good. I agree.
But here's the other thing I'm going to say. One of the really cool things that happened during the pandemic was my husband and I got to try tons of different places. We would go get carry out. We tried to support lots of small businesses. So we ate out more probably during that time than we ever had before. Mm-hmm. And so we got to try tons of really great small restaurants around the city that maybe you wouldn't have heard of. So I would just tell anybody, instead of like going to the same place all the time, go check out some of the small places, the small businesses, the restaurateurs that we have in Columbus who are amazing. We have incredible ethnic food here. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're lucky to have as many restaurants as we have. So I would really encourage people to go do that.
Yeah. Well, Sandy, this has been fantastic. We really appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, of course, good luck with everything the remainder of 2023. And once you guys figure out everything with Intel, we'll have you on again in a couple years and talk about how that project
It's all going to be good. Well, thanks for your time. I appreciate the opportunity. And we have a good community, and we just all got to stick towards the goal together.
100%. Thank you, Sandy. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Rust Belt Rundown. Make sure you check us out at rustbeltrecruiting.com. The Rust Belt Rundown is available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Make sure to hit that subscribe button and click on 5 stars if you enjoyed this episode. See you next time.